So it's really a pleasure to be able to introduce Tap. So there's a lot to say about him, and I know him well. I've known him for a long time. And when I was trying to summarize what I could say about him, one word that came to mind is non-traditional. Tap's non-traditional ways started back when he was a grad student, or probably even before that, but definitely when he was a graduate student at Washington, where he was doing his PhD in computer science. And he was on a research path that was good and from a research perspective, producing, you know, the types of results that you needed to get a PhD. But he was working in some very obscure technology, and ultimately he started to feel disconnected and disillusioned with the work he was doing. So in the middle of his PhD, he stopped and he decided to move to India, and actually was basically going to just take a complete break from his research and do something completely different. And that's what he ended up doing. He went to India and ended up teaching computer science at a Gujarati language university in Gujarat, completely away from his research and just kind of feeling like he needed to detach. So he did that for some time, and then through that experience got back into work that was sort of his initial interest, technology, but in a very different way. So being in India, he was around, you know, communities of people who actually didn't have access to very fancy technology, if any at all. And so he was moved to try to come up with different ways to make technology much more accessible to people who didn't have access and appropriate given the sort of constraints of people in India where, you know, people are in rural areas, maybe people don't speak English, people have literacy barriers. So all of these sorts of challenges in trying to meet people's needs from a technology perspective came up, and that ended up becoming interesting research, which I'm sure we'll get into. But Tap ended up going on to become sort of a pioneer in this research area that's now known as information communication technology for development, where people try to come up with, you know, appropriate technologies for development problems or development issues around the world. So that his whole PhD process actually took him 10 years. So it's not a typical path. You know, he was in one direction and then he went off into another. But ultimately, he was in a path, or he ended up in a direction that was very fulfilling to him. And in that process, benefited many, many people who wouldn't have otherwise even had access. So after his PhD, Tap became a professor, which he currently is at UC Berkeley in the School of Information. And he does many things there that, like most professors do. But again, I would call Tap a very non-traditional professor. Most professors do two things. They do teaching and research. And in their research, they work through students. I was actually one of Tap's students. I was his first student. And what happens is you train your students to do research at an academic level so that they can in turn become themselves researchers or professors. But something peculiar has happened with Tap's students. All of them, none of them have become researchers as far as my count goes. Everybody has gone off and done very, very practical things in the world along this line of trying to, you know, reach unreached people, giving people voices where they would otherwise not be heard, trying to mobilize communities in interesting ways, empower people. And so all of TAP students are all now basically running startups in some form or the other around the world. And trying to do good, and I think I would say that that's something that Tap is actually proud of, though non-traditional. I think for him, he's motivated to do things that you know, really matter to people and that can affect people in hopefully positive ways. And, you know, for me, it's, I can't understate how much of an influence TAP has had on me in my life. I mean, he's really changed the direction of my entire life. Working with him as a PhD student, working on sort of the kind of technology and the kind of work that was really meaningful to me, he really enabled that. And so even on a personal level, I really feel that he's had a very positive impact on me, if not the world. So it's a real pleasure to have him. I am looking forward to having him share. I will get through some of his very many accolades. So I have a list of them. So I'm going to just name a few. TAP was honored with the William Chan Memorial Award for his dissertation at the University of Washington. It was awarded a Best Dissertation Award. Since then, he's been named a MIT Technology Review Humanitarian of the Year. That was in 2007. And more recently, he received the NSF Career Research Award, which is one of the most, if not the most, prestigious awards for young academics, young professors in the U.S. So we're really lucky to have TAP in general, and we're really lucky to have him here to share. So I guess with that, we can go into Q&A, Nipun, or
yeah.
How does it work?
No, not Q&A. Yeah, moderated Q&A with you and TAP. So Tapan, welcome.
Sure.
And I'm glad I heard a few more of those accolades that we can use for later. But welcome to the Forest Call, Tapan.
Well, thank you very much. You know, it's a real pleasure to be with you guys. You know, I enjoyed listening to all of your sharing. And it's always a kind of a risky pleasure to be introduced by one's own student, I should say. And it's great to be introduced by Neil. So much of the last few years we've walked together on this path, and so it's really nice to hear his take on that time together and what it's meant for him. It certainly meant a lot for me.
Yeah. Thank you. And then, so I think we give him an A- on that one. So Neil, take it away.
All right. So I have a few questions here that maybe we can use to get the ball rolling. So TAP, you know, I kind of shared a little bit about your background, but it'd be great to sort of hear from you sort of what motivated you when you started your career, and also what motivates you now? Has that changed over time in terms of the work that you do?
That's a good question. You know, so I never really thought of myself as having a career, really. You know, that was part of the motivation. You know, in some sense, everything that's happened to me has been accidental, or just following whatever motivated me at any given point, as opposed to looking too far down the road. So I guess when this particular career started was when I first went to India and I first started traveling. And let's see, what was motivating me? So it's funny that you call me non-traditional, because I am, certainly. I've always been non-traditional, I should say, in some way. I don't know. Non-traditional or contrarian, you know, not going along with what other people had to say, and you know, sometimes for good reasons and sometimes for no reason at all, but just being contrarian. But the ironic thing is, you know, what got me onto this path, why I originally traveled to India, was I wasn't really into technology stuff that much. I was like, well, yeah, we can make these, you know, better compilers, and then they'll be 0.1% faster, and then, you know, some guy who's trying to compile a C program will have to wait, you know, have that much less time to go get his coffee. You know, those are the kinds of problems I was working on. And so, you know, that didn't feel very motivating to me. And so then I, you know, whenever I start thinking about things, I try to get to the root of the thing. And so And I started thinking, you know, what's the point of it all? You know, why do any of these things? Why compile programs in the first place? Why write programs? You know, why computers? Why any of this stuff? So I started thinking about that. And whenever I start thinking about that and I start thinking about philosophy, I always think, well, you know, the ancient Indians had it right. They must have had some answers. And so I convinced myself that I needed to go and learn Sanskrit so I could read all the Vedas and all the Upanishads and all the old texts so that I have all the answers. And so I figured out that I'll go to India and I'll learn Sanskrit. And at the same time, you know, I come from a kind of, a Bunya working family, and so I couldn't just do that on its own. I needed to be earning some money and, you know, making myself feel useful. And so at the same time, I was reading a lot of Gandhian literature, his autobiography and stuff. And so I ended up in India. You know, I emailed this university that was a university that Gandhi started in Ahmedabad, Gujarat Vidyapith, and I found out they have a computer science department, and I also found out they have Sanskrit classes. And so I said, I'll go do those two things. You know, I'll learn Sanskrit, and then I'll teach on the side to make some money and make myself feel useful. So that would be the exchange. You know, I would learn, and I would also teach. So I went there, I showed up, and I had all these kind of, you know, I was really clueless about India, you know, like, I'd gone a couple of times when I was growing up, you know, 3 or 4 times, but it had been a while, and, you know, I'd always resisted the idea of India somehow, and my parents and everybody in my family was shocked. You were going to India voluntarily, you know, I can't believe that, you know, and so everyone was shocked that I was going to India and voluntarily, and so I was so clueless about it. You know, when I thought about India and what the Vidyapith would be, you know, I had this image of, like, it's going to be this idyllic place on a riverbank, and, you know, like, you know, pre-Vedic Indian times, you know, that's going to be quiet and, you know, really, you know, I'll be able to do a lot of good thinking. And so I show up at Vidyapith, and it's on Ashram Road in Ahmedabad. Quite a different environment than I had in my mind. And so I show up there, and immediately, you know, I'm I took a little time off. I got there a month early, and so I did some traveling around, which was a lot of fun, just wandering and writing and reading, and, you know, that was a lot of fun. But, you know, I never had the backpacker's mentality. So, you know, as soon as I was out there, it'd be 3 or 4 days, and I'd be like, well, you know, I need to do some work. And I don't know where that comes from, you know. I don't know if it comes from a good place or a bad place, but it comes from somewhere, probably from my dad. You know, got to get some work done. And so I ended up back at Vidyapith pretty soon and started teaching when the semester started. And so I started teaching and started taking the Sanskrit class. Well, now the Sanskrit class, you know, the Sanskrit class was taught in Hindi. And so I hardly understand Hindi, you know, and so I couldn't tell when they were going back and forth between Hindi and Sanskrit. It all sounded the same to me. So I'm sitting in the class, and I quickly failed the class, you know. I was just clueless in there. And so there goes that one scheme of, you know, figuring all this ancient literature out. And so I, you know, just focused on the teaching, which was a lot of fun. And so that's how I got to where I was. And you know, one you know, again, just accident, things happen. You know, one day this professor from IIM came, Anil Gupta, and he gave a talk in Hindi. And so, you know, I only caught like 30% of it because it was in Hindi. But, you know, his oratory was so strong. And at some point he started talking about computers, and I was like, and he's talking about rural farmers and stuff. And so I was like, that sounds interesting. And so I went to see him. And he kind of got me into this space of using technology for rural development. You know, I can tell a longer story about that, but maybe that was at least my original motivation. And, you know, my initial motivation of getting into that, you know, I didn't have any agenda. You know, Professor Gupta had an agenda, but my personal agenda was always just to kind of wander around with a purpose, just to get to meet people, to know them, to understand different perspectives, to understand different people's life stories, and to just learn from that, you know, just to learn from the experience of hearing other people's stories and hearing other people's opinions and ideas and everything. And so that first trip I made with Professor Gupta, you know, he has this thing called Shodhyatra, where he walks around from village to village and just conducts meetings and, you know, finds the mad scientists from the village, the people who have crazy ideas, and you walk around. And I just met so many people, in particular a few farmers from Saurashtra that I became really good friends with on the trip. And you know, that was my first experience kind of hearing how other people live. And the really interesting thing about it was, you know, first of all, they spoke Gujarati, so I could understand them. So that was a big plus over the Hindi. And when I spoke to them, you know, here was a farmer from, you know, Saurashtra in India, and had a very different life than me. You know, grew up there, you know, basically got through fifth grade and then had been a farmer ever since. But was just an incredibly clever guy. And the conversations we had and the discussions we had, you know, it was like we were, you know, we were just friends. You know, it was nothing like there was this big gap between us. And that just, you know, it was just an awesome feeling to realize that everyone in the world, no matter how different they may look or their stories are or their histories are or what language they speak, they're just really, really similar at heart, you know, the way they think and the ideas that they have and what they care about and what motivates them. So that was, you know, that was always been kind of my motivation since then, is that at some point, at some level, our stories are very different. You know, we have very different lives and very different perspectives and very different life experiences. But at another level, our stories are also similar in terms of what we care about and what motivates us and our curiosity. And so, ever since then, I've just been wanting to bring people together, even though at the surface level they may be different, you know, to look for that commonality. And I guess that's how I got into the work that I did.
And do you think that becomes a design principle for technology? I know technology is one of your, you know, one of the areas in which a lot of your manifest work happens. And so I wonder if you can speak a little bit about how some of your journey turned into design principles for technology, and perhaps how that is different from the status quo of most other technology designers or even researchers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that did, you know, at a surface level, definitely a lot of the work that I've done has been around either design principles or new kinds of configurations of technology that take advantage of both the skills and the experience people have and the literacies that people have and kind of meets them where they are instead of forcing people to come to a place that was designed for a group of people that were very much unlike them and for a set of skills and literacies that weren't necessarily the ones that they had and relied on devices and infrastructure that they didn't have access to. And so, you know, a lot of the design principles has been kind of at that level, you know, the level of, you know, how do we both design kind of user interfaces in a way that take advantage of what people already know and what they're comfortable with, and so that they don't feel like that they have to put themselves in an unfamiliar or an uncomfortable space to be able to interact online or with technology, and also takes advantage of the technologies that they have access to. So a lot of that has been around, you know, one direction has been around using mobile phones instead of computers because that's what people happen to have. And unless you want them to go to a cyber cafe or you're only trying to serve younger people who are, you know, working with computers, you know, to meet people where they are, sometimes you have to use phones. And, you know, a lot of that work has been with Neil, especially over the last 6 or 7 years. And, you know, with Neil also, you know, the work that we did together, or I should say that he did and I advised, was around not necessarily always using text, but also using voice as a way of interacting with people in kinds of online environments. And so, that, you know, at a certain level, that's about the kind of user interface and the technology and the devices that one would use. And I think that's only part of the answer. You know, it's only part of the story. And the second set of design principles, which I don't think we've done as good of a job articulating yet, because I think it's still a work in progress, to be honest, are principles for the use of technology. You know, when and how and where to use it, and how to use it appropriately. And so that, I think, you know, we're all struggling with as a society. And as both users and designers and creators of technology, is that when is the use of technology appropriate? You know, when does it support our needs and desires to be human, as opposed to when does it make us less human? And I think that's still a very much an open question and something that I still spend a lot of time thinking about.
I was wondering, you know, so like one thing that's interesting about Tap as a technologist, if people call him that, is that, you know, like he spends a lot of time even so far talking about things that are non-technical, and it's more about, you know, I think what motivates him is human things, you know, and I think the humanitarian technology title of this call is very appropriate. And I think, I'm really excited also about some of the recent stuff that you're doing, Tap, with mapping and so on. Could you talk a little bit about what you've been most recently excited about? And I mean, because I think people kind of peg you as sort of the technology for development guy, but I think it's really exciting to see some of the other stuff that's come out, especially most recently.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I should definitely say, you know, at some point in this call and throughout it, you know, as I was just talking to Nipun the other day when we met and he came to my office, we had a long talk, is that I really don't feel like I have many answers for people. You know, I really just have more questions. that's always been my story. You know, every step in my life has just led to more questions as opposed to any kind of answers. And I think maybe, you know, maybe there's a curve somewhere where at some point I'll start running out of questions and having to answer some of them. But for me, it's always just been more questions, you know, and the more I live and the more I see the world and the more I experience my own life and my interactions with people and with situations and with environments, I just have more questions, you know, very few answers. So I should say that up front, you know, for those of you who are, you know, I know you have some very, you know, distinguished people on the call, and for those of you who are looking for some, you know, some conclusive answers, you know, maybe next week. But I just have a lot of questions, and so, so you know, I really, you know, the questions that interest me right now, and I'll try to relate it to some of the things I'm doing. I guess one of the big question that I have right now is that, you know, what is it that makes us human, and what does it mean to be human? I mean, that's one of, you know, it's such a big question. It's one of the original questions that we've had as living, conscious, sentient beings, and it's one that I've thought about a lot and continue to think about a lot. And I think it's particularly relevant now because so many of our personal and social interactions are now mediated by technology, and the kind of boundaries and distinctions between our own personal lives as human beings and social beings, and the relation of that to technological affordances and infrastructure is getting more and more nebulous. Just as a few examples, you know, everyone is on social media, and, you know, we are substituting a lot of offline interactions potentially with online or mediated by various forms of technology, including the one we're using now. And so what does that mean? You know, what does it mean for our ability to understand ourselves as being human and our ability to understand other people as being human when potentially, you know, what we're saying is either being mediated or even in some sense being generated by a technological artifact? And so, for me, that means, again, in a very contrarian way, it's building technologies that, in some sense, resist automation or resist efficiency or resist categorization or resist quantification. And so, you know, Neil, your work, you know, in some sense, with voice, some of our first experiments in that space, you know, because when you talk to people about that kind of work, the immediate reaction is, well, you can't search it, you know, that's the first thing people say, you know, you're doing voice, well, then you can't search it, you know, well, that's
right.
The point, maybe.
That's right.
And, you know, it's going to take up, you know, it's going to be very difficult to categorize and filter and automate, and why wouldn't you just do something cheaper like SMS, which takes up so much less bandwidth? And so I think there's an interesting kind of tension there in that something is cheaper and more efficient and easier to categorize and easier to index and easier to search and easier to quantify versus something that isn't, but provides some more accessibility and richness and nuance and feeling that text and aggregation could never provide. And so, you know, again, not an answer, but a question. You know, what makes that different? You know, and what makes it different? You know, is it somewhere in between for it to be asynchronous as opposed to synchronous? Do you lose something in the asynchronity of it? And you know, where is this continuum of how we used to interact and how now we're interacting in ways that are mediated by technology? And can we play with that continuum in ways that expose some of the dimensions of the design space?
That's really interesting, Tep. You're building technology that resists quantification. I mean, it's very counterintuitive. I was wondering how you juxtapose that and Ray Kurzweil and that whole sort of singularity university and that movement, if you want to call it that, which is the age of spiritual machines, which is let's embed technology into everything and let's, you know, you start to lose some of the art element of it. So how are you... How do you juxtapose this for yourself, and what are your positions on some of what Singularity is doing?
Again, more questions. So, you know, Kurzweil is interesting. I didn't know he was speaking tonight. Maybe I'll try to go. So, I actually saw Kurzweil speak once at his birthday party. You know, I was just on the MIT campus, and I was walking around, and I had a meeting with a friend of mine at MIT. And he came out of a seminar to come meet me and just have a chat. And at the end of our chat, he's like, you really need to come into this room. You know, it's a really interesting thing going on. So I said, sure, I'm not doing anything. So I went in there, and it happened to be Ray Kurzweil's birthday party. And so I'm there, and it was a day-long seminar, and it was all about the singularity, and Kurzweil was there, and Kurzweil's advisor was also there. Marvin Minsky was there, and a bunch of other MIT people. And so they had a bunch of talks going on, and everything was asymptotic. You know, everything was, you know, if you follow the singularity, a lot of it's about basically asymptotic or exponential growth in one way or another.
Hello.
So when I showed up, the talk that was going on was there was an astronaut there, and the astronaut was talking about, you know when we live forever, you know, as in the singularity we're expected to do, when humans can upload their brains and live forever, it'll be great, because then I can go to Alpha Centauri and come back, and my friends won't be dead. That was his rationale, and talk after talk like this of this nature, just how things are going to be awesome when we can live forever, and how everything's going to be so much better, and you know, there's all this asymptotic growth in all these different ways. And finally, Kurzweil talks, and he talks about some of the same things, and Minsky talks, and he talks about some of the same things. And on one hand, I'm sitting there, and I'm thinking, I've always respected MIT because they're ambitious, you know, and I think MIT in some sense reflects this culture of engineering and quantification and math and symbolic manipulation, and being able to use those capabilities to do just amazing things from a perspective of engineering. So I've always respected MIT, and I've always respected that perspective. That's why I'm an engineer, and I interact with those kinds of people every day, and I do respect them because of their ambition, because of their optimism, because of their belief that things can and should be better. So I've always respected that perspective, and I'm not by any means against symbols or numbers or quantification. But, you know, I think in doing that, I think in becoming and thinking of things as abstract and in terms of symbols and in terms of numbers, we often forget that they're only abstractions, that they're only capture a small percentage of what it means to be human and what it means to be alive and all of the different feelings that we have and all of the beliefs that we have and all of the hopes and aspirations that we have. And so I think when you think about things like the singularity and all this asymptotic growth, you often forget to reinterpret it from the perspective of what and what it means to be alive. And so that's why I thought the astronauts comment was so interesting, is that he was thinking about his friends, you know, he was thinking about living forever, he was thinking about his friends,
yeah.
And how he could spend more time with them, and I thought that was a very human thing to say, you know, and And so, you know, when I was there in this room with these guys, I couldn't resist asking a question, you know, because, you know, when are you going to get this opportunity again? And so I think I was still a grad student at this time, and so I raised my hand. No one knew who I was. You know, who's this dude in the room? I don't think he was invited. I raised my hand, and I asked a question to Ray Kurzweil. And Ray Kurzweil, so the question was, well, you know, everything is asymptotic. Everything is growing really fast. You know, and technology is moving really fast. You know, but I think the one thing that's not keeping up with these growth rates is our human ability to deal with that rate of change. You know, we're not able, either individually, psychologically, or socially, or culturally, to adapt our ways of thinking about the world and to build in the protection mechanisms that allow us to reason and deal with about this rapid change, you know. And so I went on to say, if you look at rates of behavioral or mood illnesses, you know, they're also exponential and they're also growing incredibly fast, and that's an indication that we're not keeping up. You know, we're not keeping up with these rates of change. And so what do you have to say? And I asked Ray Kurzweil, and so Kurzweil's answer was, hey, listen, I take vitamins, I work out, I feel awesome. I don't know about you guys, but I feel great. And so that was Kurzweil's answer. And then, I think I did ask a good question, because Marvin Minsky felt obliged to stand up and answer too. And so after Kurzweil answers, Minsky gets up and he says, he basically told a story of, you know, one time I was giving a talk at a convention of cigarette smokers or something like that, someone not very productive. And I asked people, what do you want to do with your lives? And nobody raised their hand. You know, nobody wanted to do anything with their lives. And then I was at an MIT freshman undergraduate seminar, and I asked the same question, and everyone raised their hands. And so that shows that, you know, people like MIT are goal-oriented. They have goals in their lives, and if they live forever, they'd get some stuff done.
Because, you know, the goal of life is to get stuff done.
Exactly. So his perspective was, even if the rest of you can't keep up, at MIT we'll do fine. And so those are the answers I got, you know. And so so that's how, you know, and again, no answers, but I only have questions, you know. And the question is, you know, I don't think anyone's really keeping up. And so how do we think about the pace of technological advancement and more broadly speaking, growth in our civilization and society in a way that as human beings we can keep up, and that our social and cultural forms can provide us the solace that we need in times of confusion and uncertainty.
Yeah, oh, that's great. We're just hitting up at 10 o'clock, and I'll let Neil conclude with the final question before we open up the lines. But for those of you that have questions for Thubben, you can get in the queue by hitting *6. These could be questions about, you know, about teaching and being a professor, or things like personal values, like what role does ambition play, or what role does dissatisfaction play in this, or it just could be larger state of the world, where we're talking about Ray Kurzweil, and you know, we're sort of making light of it, but here's a guy who's like he's influencing billions of dollars of investment, and really the future of technology. He's a director of engineering at Google now, I understand too. So you know, how do you balance those things, and you know, what role do we even have is there opposition to that? So all those questions, any of those themes, they're all fair game. And I will hand it back to Neil to ask the last question before we go into the queue.
All right. So I feel like the one question that was on my mind from the beginning is sort of almost organically being brought up based on what Tap was saying. I wanted to hear, I think a lot of people on this call in particular are interested in sort of, you know, how spirituality and spiritual values play a role in one's life and one's work. And I'd like to ask Tap, about his spirituality and how his work informs it, and vice versa. And in particular, you know, just keeping with the theme of technology, in a world where, you know, as you've kind of brought up, you know, technology is sort of moving faster and faster, and on the other hand, you know, you have spiritual progress with, you know, in many traditions talks about detachment. How do we reconcile those things?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, you know, and
that's why we pay him the big bucks.
Spiritual values and spirituality. I mean, I think for me, in terms of spirituality, you know, I consider myself basically, you know, a karma yogin at some level. And so I try to learn more about myself and more about the world and to gain a deeper sense of self and detachment through work and through commitment to work. And so for me, in terms of kind of ideas of detachment and ideas of, it's very difficult still, I should say, you know, is that it's not something that I've completely resolved for myself or, and it's very easy to get tied up in the work and in the results of the work and in the recognition of the work. Very easy to get tied up in all of those things. And so for me, that process is one of being able to observe those kind of attachments that come through work and using those that observation as a way to understand and to practice detachment from the results and from the outcomes. And one way I've been one way that I've not, I shouldn't say, well, maybe, you know, forced to do that, I guess, is becoming a teacher or a professor, is that then by necessity at some level your work becomes indirect, you know, is that your main job is to teach and to advise and to mentor. And so the outcomes that you should be focused on are the outcomes in your students and in the people that you teach and you advise and you mentor. And not directly with the work itself or with the outcomes of the work. And so that's something that's, you know, from a person who's always had goals and ambition and a vision and an agenda, it's been a constant effort to kind of remind myself that my job now is not to do the work, but it is to advise and teach and mentor other people who do that work, and to obtain fulfillment from that process. And so, you know, I think now, after 5 years of being a professor, I really fully appreciated that and fully become comfortable with that and fully enjoy that as the best and most fulfilling part of my job. But it wasn't always that way, because when I first started as a professor, it wasn't to teach, it was to do work, because I had some real definite goals that I wanted to achieve, and which only now I realize would probably be impossible to achieve, because goals are always elusive and they always lead to new goals. And so I think now it really, you know, I really understand, I'm not sure I'm equipped to do so, but I definitely understand that my job in terms of teaching and advising in this area of humanitarian technology, or, you know, maybe what I'd probably call it is humanist technology, is not in developing technology, but it's in training humans and in helping people learn as much from their own path as I have learned from mine. And so that's what I've been busy doing and focusing on. And you know, Nipun recently got back from India, and asked him how you were, Neil, and the only question I had for him is, are you happy? The only question I had, and I was really happy to hear that he said yes.
Neil's very happy.
Awesome.
That's great. So we'll just go to we'll go to our queue. We have a caller, and again, it's a reminder: if you have questions for Tapan, hit *6, and you'll be prompted when it's your chance to speak. We'll go to the first caller.
Hi, this is Michelle Ehlers from Santa Fe, and I am just full of gratitude with the work that you're doing. I spoke earlier at the beginning of the call about my father passing away recently and planning the celebration of his life. And he taught social work, and my biggest memory of childhood is teaching field work in Zambia and Central Africa. And what you talked about having questions and not answers, I'm sure if he's listening to this call, he'll be very happy with the work that you're doing, because he always said that he wanted to get people to understand that what there is to do is search, not research, not research what's already been learned, but search for new things. And that's what he had his students in the field looking for what services were needed, what he had them do. So thank you for continuing his work and having me feel that his life is still in action and meaningful. So thank you for that. My question is, I've spent a lot of time in my life looking at what I call transformational global leadership, and I was very excited about some of the things that you've talked about, particularly with the role of technology and humanity and the conversation about Ray Kurzweil and all of that. I've been involved in technology in its usage, both in terms of learning and connecting people, because that's what I do, is I connect humanity, and have been focusing in the past few years on what does it take to really the entity humanity, and how do we connect with the entity humanity, and what is that as a connection, as a collection of human beings? And I'm wondering if you have thought about that or can speak to it. The kind of technology you're involved with is what I see as maybe useful and a gift if used appropriately with a focus on humanity rather than the technology itself, to support us in becoming aware of the oneness of humanity and that entity. Can you speak to that, what you see about it, what you've done with it, what you see might be available in that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, it's a great honor to be able to live in a way that reinforces your father's values. You know, that means a lot to me in terms of being able to live up to those that have walked before, and so I really appreciate your saying that. In terms of humanity and the ability to appreciate the entity called humanity through technology, well, I think we encounter humanity every time we encounter a human being, and if we really look and understand and look deeply into that person, humanity exists within every single one of us. And so I think in terms of the technologies that we try to build, and I'm not saying we're completely successful or we completely understand all of the dimensions of the design space, but at least there is a sincere effort in both the design process and in the resulting artifacts to be able to provide and make the effort to look deeper into people and into who they are, and to give those affordances in the design process and the resulting tools to be able to look deeper and to provide that deeper connection. And so in the design process, that just means when you make things, go and talk to people first before you make them. And that seems obvious, and I guess a lot of people are saying that, but I think it's really important, and I still think we don't spend enough time just talking with people and walking with people and being with people before we decide how to serve them, because service is something that requires deep understanding of people and who they are and what they want to be and how you can best serve that. And I still think we try to rush that process even in the work that we do now. And in terms of the technologies that we build, I think the goals that we have, or the design values that we try to reflect are, again, know, the technologies that don't distill the essence of being human to just a sequence of characters or a number or a graphic, but try to represent who those people are in some deeper and more meaningful way, and also give people the ability to construct their own identities and their own representations so that they can provide us the opportunities to see them.
Oh, that's great. Great. We have a bunch of questions in the queue, so we'll just go to the next caller.
Hi, this is Deven from India.
Hi.
Hello, we can hear you.
Yeah. So the question is that, you know, when the social media and tech platforms like Facebook and Twitter were built, I'm sure none of the founders would have imagined that something like an Arab Spring revolution, you know, will happen using these platforms. So, you know, increasingly we are seeing, you know, more and more nonprofits and activists, you know, using the power of social media platforms towards good causes. But, you know, since these platforms are essentially, you know, for-profit valuation-chasing entities, you know, they come with their own downsides of advertising and commercial biases. So, you know, what are your thoughts on whether will these, you know, large social media platforms kind of coexist for both commercial and social purposes, or will we see an emergence of a new kind of a technology and social media platform which would be exclusively for, you know, for good initiatives?
I think the good isn't in the platform, you know. The good is in the people who use the platform. So I totally think we can have platforms that are commercial in nature, but still used for good. We could have platforms that are not commercial in nature that are used for good. But again, they will be in the use, not in the platform. And I think that's where some of the discussion around the use of these kinds of social media sites in fostering kind of revolutions or social unrest has been in some sense misdirected, because we're looking for agency in the platforms, not in the people who are using those platforms. And when we think about who and what to support, we think about the platforms and recognizing the platforms, which is just, you know, bits and bytes and people sitting in offices in Silicon Valley, and not those people who are living lives day to day in places where they're facing oppression of different kinds. And so I think those people often get overlooked. And if we do look at people, we look at those people through their tweet streams or through their Facebook posts, and not through their stories and their lives and who they are and the struggles that they face and how they need support as people, as individuals, and not necessarily only technological support, all different kinds of support. And so, I think one thing I think is that the good is in the people, not in the platform. And the other thing I would say is that it's nice if the platform supports that. You know, it's nice if the platform supports the people and has that as its first and primary goal. And I think that would result in a different set of values and behaviors and reactions to attention than if they're serving their shareholders, or if they're serving their advertisers, or if they're serving different markets. That said, you know, I think in many instances, a lot of these social media platforms have genuinely considered, not always, you know, they're not always incentivized to do so, but the interesting thing is even when they are not incentivized to do so, they have acted in the interests of their users, and even users that are not in their quote-unquote target market. And so, again, you know, I think good is in the people, and a lot of the people who run these quote-unquote commercial media platforms have good in them, and that's been shown and reflected in some of their actions.
Just as a follow-up, Tupin, I mean, on that juicy question, that excellent question that Devin asked, you know, I think Facebook, one of the things they're worried about as sort of a five-year trend is that they're getting a lot of you know, the trillions of connections among the billion-plus people on Facebook are getting cheaper and cheaper in the sense that there's just a lot of noise. There's now new research that was, I think, just released last month that talked about how the younger teens are really dropping off of Facebook in greater numbers than any other demographic amongst the younger population. And so there Facebook is now saying, and one of our own service-based ambassadors is in on this question, is saying, how do we deepen those connections? And so let's talk about compassion now. And so there's this whole committee of people that are saying, how do we make Facebook more compassionate? And so to instead of cheapening the traffic, you're now using compassion to make it more valuable in some sense. But this is A, an afterthought, and B, to increase the evaluation and a response to some of the, you know, trends that they're seeing. And so my question would be, you know, what if this wasn't an afterthought, and what if this was a forethought, right? What if you designed for this up front? And I know you've thought about this as well. I mean, and so do you, and not just Facebook, like what if you put that in the front as you're designing and kind of like what you do with your students. So any thoughts on how we can do more of that? Should we have different incubators that support this kind of values-driven implementation, values up front, or do you think we can just modify the existing status quo and touch the hearts of these people and the hearts of the users, like you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in the analogy, a platform is kind of like a place, and it's just like being able to create a structure that holds people and their conversations and their social exchanges. And I think what we're living through now is going to be relatively short term. I mean, right now the ability to create these kinds of spaces is limited to just this very small number of organizations, or I shouldn't say small, quite a number of organizations, but in some sense there are some barriers, some of them artificial, some of them real, for anyone to be able to create their own space on the Internet. And I think there is this kind of mistaken belief on the Internet that there will eventually just be this one space that holds us all. And that's going to be called Facebook, or that's going to be called Twitter, or that's going to be called Google Plus or something. I don't think that's going to be how it plays out, and I think it'd be very sad if it does play out that way, because different places facilitate different kinds of experiences and groups of people and different kinds of interactions and have different inherent values and energy of their own. And so, I think service space is a great example of a space on the Internet where a different set of things are happening and a different kind set of exchanges are happening and a different set of people are interacting and a different level of connections are being created. And so I look forward in the future of the Internet where, all of these kinds of things end up, you know, the kind of infrastructure and the software ends up being very, very cheap and ends up being just a commodity. And so we can really have a flourishing of all different kinds of spaces on the Internet where very different kinds of groups of people are doing very, very different kinds of things, and they'll have interesting kinds of overlaps and interactions within and amongst one another. And I think we need to make some architectural decisions in the Internet to allow that to occur, but the positive side is that the creators of the Internet were always thinking about that kind of diversity, and they were always thinking about that kind of decentralization, and it's baked in at a certain level to the design of the Internet to have that possibility. But the question is just now, with the evolution of the Internet, will we make the same choices in the design of the next set of features and the next set of infrastructure? And I think that's still very much an open question. And it's being colored by commercial interests, and commercial interests have always favored centralization and certain forms of control. Not always, I should say. Not always, but see, in recent history they seem to have. And so it just remains to be seen whether or not the architects of the Internet will have their way, or will they be swayed by other political and economic forces outside of their control.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll go to the next question. Next caller.
Hi, this is Bill from Palo Alto. Yeah, here in the Silicon Valley, there seems to be such a fascination with technology as an end in itself, and people like Kurzweil seem to feel that we're evolving toward a state where we'll become ever more dependent on the mechanical world, and I'm just curious if you think in the long term, you know, a few decades or maybe even a few centuries down the road, do you think technology will be a bigger and bigger part of our lives, or do you see it maybe as just a temporary crutch that's helping us to evolve toward a more, I don't know, conscious, spiritual, psychic state of being?
Well, I think these big trends in human society are in some sense really hard to predict because they're dependent on factors that we just don't have. You know, there are so many dependencies and they're so complicated, and sometimes they turn on just, you know, very, very random sets of circumstances and occurrences. But it's kind of really impossible to predict what will happen, I think. And I think by predicting, you also, in some sense, de-emphasize your own agency in deciding what's going to happen. And so I think we have a choice. I really think we all, as individuals, have a choice, and we as a society have a choice to decide what role technology will play in our individual lives, in our social lives, in our political lives, in our economic lives. And I think the risk is believing that we don't have a choice, that technology is just a force in and of itself and is advancing in its own way, and that we're just along for the ride. And I think that's the thinking, that kind of unreflective thinking, that's potentially the most dangerous and potentially the least respectful of how much agency we do have as human beings and as a society. And so I just hope we recognize that we do have choices and as individuals, as a society, and that we should be making those choices in an informed way and with a clear sense of what we care about and what we find important in our lives and in our relationships.
Thank you.
All right. So I think we're almost at the end of our time. So I think we have time for one more question. Is that right, Nipun, that
yeah,
I will ask?
Go for it. Go for it.
All right. So I have a question for Tap that I've been meaning to ask him since we've had this conversation. So me and Tap were sitting in our office, in his office one day, and we were talking about doing work and being productive. And I told Tap, and we were talking about meditation and how I meditate. I told him, you know, Tap, for me, I feel most productive when I feel most balanced, like I have the most mental balance. And then Tap responds, he says, you know when I'm the most productive? When I'm angry.
Contrary.
So I'd like to ask Tap to elaborate on that.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's always a risk what you say in your office, especially to your own students, you know. It always comes back to haunt you. Then that's a great question. In fact, something that I've very actively been wrestling with just over the last 6 months. You know, as Nipun knows, I mentioned some of this to him when he came to see me a couple of days ago. You know, I think I had that phase in my life. You know, I definitely had that phase in my life where that was what was motivating to me, was this competitive spirit and this kind of angst, you know, and you know, the angst comes from a lot of different places. You know, it comes from being a minority, it comes from being contrarian, comes from being someone who identified with the underdog, and so that was really motivating and led to a lot of the work I did in terms of serving diverse people and the poor and different populations, was this basic anger and angst at their position and the unfairness of it and things of that nature. So that was motivating for a long time, and I learned a lot from pursuing that direction and in some sense from coming face to face with the futility of it. And in the last 6 months, I've really, you know, have had that real feeling of the futility of it. You know, the futility of resistance, the futility of anger, the futility of fighting back. You know, in some sense. And so, you know, I shouldn't say I've given up, but I've, and it's not that I've given up as much as I've. What's a different word? Given out? I don't know. Is a different way of thinking about it. And so in the last 6 months, I've very much realize that, and come to this place where I think a lot of you have come to before, and in fact where I started this process, you know, and 10, 12 years ago, is that to change the world, you know, one must first change oneself. And so you know, that's something I've really appreciated again, you know, after 10 years of fighting the fight, that, you know, in fighting the fight, I forgot that the first thing I need to change is myself. And so in the last 6 months, I've really looked deeply into myself, and just in terms of my daily practices and the way I interact with my family and my children and what I consume in food and other substances and just a daily practice of mindfulness and aware of my own mental state and trying to improve that and starting from the inside out. And I think that's led to you know, much more clarity in terms of the work that I've been choosing to pursue and how I've been choosing to pursue that work, and my ability to clearly demarcate the work that I'm doing in different realms from my own personal process of self-discovery and learning, and to make sure that I maintain clarity in all the things that I do. And so, you know, I think as a teacher, as a professor, you know, you always learn more from your students than you teach. And so this is certainly an example of that, you know. And then I've always respected, Neil, your balance and your clarity and your focus and your determination I should say, you know, your cool aggression, you know, your ability to deal with all kinds of situations without losing your head about it, you know. And so I definitely learned some of that from you, and I'm trying to put it into practice in my own life.
Awesome. Thanks, Tab. That means a lot, and it's really wonderful to hear, share, and reflect, as always. Unfortunately, we're, I think, nearing the end of our time. So thanks once again to Tab for taking time to share. It was really, really a delight and pleasure to hear. And thank all of you, the callers. I was told by Nipun that everybody who joined the call at the beginning has stayed on at the end. So a really engaging conversation. Thank you all for being a part of it. We'll end with a couple minutes of gratitude, or a minute of gratitude in silence. And then I think we will have Nipun wrap up after that.
Yeah, sure. I can wrap up. And before we do that, Tapan, just really quickly, any way that we as a collective, not just service-based, not just this call, but the larger ecosystem, can any way we can be helpful to kind of support what you're doing?
Well, first of all, I just want to thank you all for being on the call and talking to me and listening to me. I wish I had a chance to listen more. You know, I always mean to join the Forest call, but then, you know, Saturday morning is also my time to spend with the children and take them to their swimming practice and things, and so, you know, other concerns come up. But I'm definitely going to try to join more. And in terms of what you can do, you know, I think I just enjoy the opportunity to continue to walk together with all of you individually and collectively. And I thank you for the opportunity to do so. And I look forward to walk together for many years more future.
Beautiful. So let's all take a minute in silence then, in the spirit of that gratitude of walking together. And then after that, we'll unmute all the lines, and we'll collectively say thank you to Tapan before we say goodbye. So maybe just 60 seconds in the spirit of gratitude for everything that brought us together, for genuine, authentic people like Tapan who are walking their talk. And certainly Neil, who has received so much from Tapan, and we have received so much from him, and all of you. So just 30 seconds in the spirit of gratitude, in silence. Thank you.
Thank you, Tapan.
Thank you all. Thanks.